This is Central Time. There's been a revolution in the world of American energy led by the process of hydraulic fracturing, better known as fracking. The process led to a boom in the production and use of natural gas in the United States, along with environmental controversy.
Wisconsin has been a part of that revolution with a boom in sand mines for use in fracking, and it's an issue in Congress this week, too. The House passed a bill that would loosen regulations on fracking, and the White House says those would be vetoed.
Our next guest tells the story of the rise of fracking and the people who made it a successful industry. Gregory Zuckerman is with us. He's a special writer for the Wall Street Journal. His new book is The Frackers, the outrageous inside story of the new billionaire wildcatters. Gregory, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
So how much has fracking changed the American energy landscape?
It's changed the energy landscape, but it's frankly changed the country, and it's going to change other nations around the world. We're moving towards energy independence. Just a few years ago, we were worried about where we were going to get our natural gas and oil. And we now produce about 8 million barrels a day of oil. That's up from about 5 in 2005. We're going to hit 11 at some point in the next few years. We're relying on Middle East for just about 8% of our oil now, and that's dropping. And we're going to be exporting natural gas in a couple of years. It's just a dramatic change. It's helping the economy, helping a lot of small-town America, and it's causing lots of controversy.
When we look at the rise of the oil industry, there were some larger-than-life characters, intense competition, some scandals and shenanigans. Is the same thing true of fracking?
Well, that's what I write about in my book. So it's a book. I write about how we went from a country running out of energy to kind of having a surplus. And, yeah, as you mentioned, there were shenanigans. There were interesting characters. There were people that you wouldn't have expected are the ones behind it. It's not Chevron and Exxon and the giants and the experts. It's a few people that believed in this country, didn't have much of a choice, didn't have offshore assets, and figured out how to hydraulically fracture or frack and drill horizontally for the first time in shale, which is a very compressed, challenging kind of rock, and they made it happen.
Why? I'm imagining the companies you just named, their executives are kicking themselves for not getting into this big money industry early on. Why didn't they?
You know, what's interesting to me, it's very much like the financial meltdown, believe it or not. The conventional wisdom back then was that housing wasn't going to collapse. And the conventional wisdom in the energy world was that this shale, this kind of rock, it looks a little bit like tombstone, couldn't really release a lot of oil and gas. We all knew, everyone knew, every geologist knew that there was a lot of oil and gas in shale. They called it source rock. It's the source for all the oil and gas that eventually, over millions of years, flows closer to the surface. But people figured it's too far down. It's about 14,000 feet below. In some places, it's too expensive to try to get this really hard rock to give up oil and gas. But a few people said, no, we're going to ignore what the Exxons of the world said. And Exxon was heading off to Africa and Asia, and they had lots of places to go. And a few people didn't have those options. And they were American wildcatters, and I write about them. And they figured out how to get this this shale to give up lots of oil and gas.
Who was the first wildcatter to make a go of it, to make it work?
So the first person was a guy named George Mitchell, and he ran a mid-sized Texas company, and they were running out of natural gas. They had to deliver about 10% of all the gas going to Chicago and some other places. And by the early 80s, he realized he was running out. His company was running out, and he told his guys, well, we're sitting on a layer of shale. Let's try to figure it out. And everyone said he's a little bit crazy, and even his own heir apparent told Mitchell's men not to work on this stuff. It's a waste of time. And Mitchell kept pushing them, and he was about 80, but finally by the late 90s, and he was getting sick. He had cancer. His wife was getting – he was even sicker, and he was close to bankruptcy at the time, personal bankruptcy, because the stock had collapsed. And finally they had an aha moment, a breakthrough, a guy named Nick Steinsberger, who really history doesn't give enough credit to. He figured out how to – the right combination of water with some chemicals and some sand to release all this gas. And then people kind of built on that breakthrough afterwards.
And that turned the company around?
Turned the company around. They sold it for $2 billion. And at the time, people said, okay, so Mitchell and his guys, they figured out how to do it in Texas, but other shale around the country, there's no way people are going to be able to get gas, and let alone oil, for sure. They didn't take oil. And then a few other people that I write about said, no, let's go figure out how to do it elsewhere. There's a guy named Harold Hamm who grew up dirt poor. He was so poor that he had to work in the fields. His parents were sharecroppers in a little town in Oklahoma. And he couldn't even go to school each year until around Christmas time, because only then was it so cold that his parents couldn't pick cotton and watermelon. So Harold Hamm started off dirt poor, and he had a dream of finding oil, and people thought he was a little nuts, and he was a little bit of an odd guy. He never went to college and didn't take geology and wasn't an engineer, but he had his belief in America and belief in his own ability to find oil, and he was a kind of old-school wildcatter, and he drove his guys into North Dakota, and one of his men said, hey, let's figure out the shale layer here and other kind of challenging layers. And today he's worth about $14 billion. He's going through a divorce, unfortunately, but his wife is going to walk away with more money than Oprah Winfrey. So it's a rags-to-riches kind of story.
And North Dakota, that's a home to a lot of the fracking, a lot of this energy boom. Why there? What is it about that place and the land and the people?
That's exactly right. So it's called the Bakken Formation, and it's an area that's always had booms and busts, and we always knew there was a lot of oil there and gas as well, but it didn't seem like the rock was going to be the kind that we could really get much out of. And it's very challenging. It's deep below the ground, as I say. It's very low, very narrow and long, these shale layers. But we always knew there was a lot of oil in there. It just didn't. Part of the reason why guys like Hamm and others headed up there is that oil and gas prices got kind of expensive around 2007, 2008. And this method, this hydraulic fracturing or fracking and horizontal drilling, is pretty expensive when you go all the way down 14,000 feet below sometimes to the shale region. So it got but since oil and gas prices were so expensive, if you remember right before the financial crisis, it was worth it for these guys to experiment and to tweak it. And it's very much a story of innovation. And, you know, America gets criticized for not innovating anymore. I joke that really all we're really good at, or what we're better than the rest of the world, is rapping, making drones, apps, and fracking. But fracking is one thing we have an advantage versus the rest of the world in.
We're talking to Gregory Zuckerman about his new book, The Frackers. It's about the rise of fracking of natural gas and oil and the people and personalities behind this energy boom.
And you can join in. Do you have a question about fracking and its role in the economy? You can call in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Thanks, Kristen. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a look at the latest developments on nuclear negotiations with Iran.
Now we continue our conversation about fracking and the booming business behind it with Gregory Zuckerman. His new book is The Frackers. We'll take your calls in just a few moments at 800-642-1234. Gregory, from a business perspective, a big success story. There's been a lot of criticism about the environmental impact of fracking, especially on water quality in nearby areas. What do you make of that argument?
So I spent a lot of time researching this and talked to all kinds of scientists and went out to various places, including Pennsylvania, which have been kind of controversial. And the way I come down on it in the book is that both sides really overstate their arguments. So the people that say fracking poisons, their three main concerns are, A, that the chemicals, and they're not chemicals we all want to ingest, the chemicals used in fracking are going to get into our water system from the places where we frack. And if you talk to sort of objective scientist types, they say it's really unlikely. The reason is we basically drill between 4,000 and 14,000 feet below the surface, and the aquifers are usually between 400 feet and 1,200 feet below the surface. And again, it's really unlikely that the chemicals somehow are going to magically make their way into the aquifers. The other concern is everyone's seen in the movies, the pictures where you turn on the faucet and you light it on fire. And that's happened. A lot of places in the country, methane has gotten into the water system. And as a result, you can light things on fire. Unfortunately, it's hard to tell. It's really unlikely that this is due to fracking. There are three towns in this country called Burning Springs. In other words, they've always been able to light things on fire. American Indians did it. I talked to old timers in some of these little towns in Pennsylvania, and they said, Greg, when we were little, we would light it on fire and the faucets on fire in school and run for it. So that's always been the case. It just happens that in some places in this country, methane naturally gets into the water. And then the last is the earthquakes, and there have been some tremors, but there are ways to avoid that. Now, I also say that the producers, the energy companies, overstate their argument, too. They say, you know, drill baby, heavy drill, which is really inappropriate because they've had poorly sealed wells, blowouts, leaks, surface spills, all kinds of things that have damaged water, damaged, and they damaged the air as well. About 1 in 10 of these wells has some cement issue that has to be fixed. So fracking can be done properly and safely, but that's not to say that it is being done properly and safely.
Is this an industry that's outrun regulation?
No, I don't think so. And they also care a lot more about the environment than you would think. I kind of went into this as a reporter thinking these are sort of cigar-chomping Houston executives kind of giggling their way to the bank and spilling left and right. And they're not like that. They're outdoors people usually. They're geologists. They like rock. They hunt. They fish. They have ranches. So they don't see themselves as being polluters. It's not to say they don't pollute. So I think they're aware of the backlash. They don't like the PR. And now big companies, we talked earlier about how the big companies didn't believe in this kind of drilling. Now they do. They're all racing back to America, the Exxons of the world. So they're doing things a little bit better. They're more conscious of these issues because they don't want the PR. Early on, it was sort of wildcatters, independent wildcatters, and they made a lot of mistakes.
We'll go to our phones now. We've got Alice with us in Sheboygan. Alice, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to call and talk a little bit about the effects it's having on Wisconsin with the sand. We have the sand mines here that the sand is going out for the fracking, and your guest brought up the water, and the water that we use for the high-capacity wells to get the sand out is really taking down our aquifers. We had a case in western Wisconsin where a farmer lost all his water due to a frack sand mine near him, and our legislature passed new regulations so the farmer couldn't do anything. And as far as the people who are doing the fracking, the people who are making money may be hunting and fishing and enjoying nice places. But a lot of the people that I have met who've been out fracking, it's a dirty job. And the
they're
not necessarily happy to have a bunch of 20-some-year-olds who come in with a lot of money and act up.
Gotcha. Alice, thanks. Let's she said that a dirty job in a couple ways, and you wanted to respond to how dirty a job is it, Gregory?
Oh, yeah, the people in the field, they're in danger. The air's quality is often bad. And it is a divisive thing. People, and I've traveled the country, in some communities, they love it. Farmers can stay in their farms, and people are moving back to small towns and a lot of the young people had been moving away. And, you know, I talked to a young man in Louisiana who makes over $100,000 a year and didn't go to college. So some people are really being helped. But if you don't own your own land, if you rent, let's say, in one of these small towns and real estate prices are going up, it hurts you. There are a lot of people that are unhappy with the crime she had suggested. And it's true, crime has increased as these cities sort of get bigger and they're busier and out-of-towners come in and workers. These aren't bad people. A lot of these people have left homes elsewhere in the country. Instead of going on unemployment, they picked up and drove somewhere like North Dakota. But, yeah, they get into trouble sometimes. And it's a mixed story. It's very great. To me, it's a great story. It's brought a lot of good. But it's also divided communities.
And she also brought up the water usage, mentioning our sand mines here in Wisconsin, but also the fracking process uses sand. Uses water. Is it enough water to make a difference in local aquifers and tap people out?
I'm not aware of that. You know more about that. I do know there's a lot of water used, about 5 million on average gallons per well. And that's a huge amount of fresh water that's used. So we as a nation, you know, have to have a discussion about whether it's worth our while. I mean, fracking takes a lot of water. So do things like golf courses, a huge amount of water. So, you know, we have to prioritize. If this is not what we want to prioritize and we want to, you know, shift elsewhere, that's fine. We need energy. So we need natural gas. And we're not ready, unfortunately, we're not ready yet for solar and wind. I'd love for there to be, and we will eventually. But we're not quite there yet, unless we want to go nuclear. I'm a big fan of nuclear, but a lot of people aren't. We, unfortunately, have to depend on natural gas.
Take a call now from Derek in Round Lake, Illinois. Derek, hi.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. Good program. As a writer and reporter myself, actually, I listen to your guest's opinions, and I think he lives in sort of a parallel universe. I just wanted to be aware that several European governments as well as American states have banned a variety of different forms of fracking, not only because of the water issue, aquifer issues, but also tectonic issues. Those things also cause earthquakes and damage. So I think you know, there's a really necessary national conversation that needs to be had specifically about benefits as well as the drawbacks of fracking. And I think it's, you know, his opinion, very positive opinion on this apparently, which doesn't tell the whole story, I think it's really troubling because American people should really be better informed than this.
Derek, thanks a lot for the call. Gregory?
You're exactly right. Other nations have banned fracking, but they're quite silly in their decision. It's a misguided decision because, as a result, their air quality, their carbon dioxide emissions are going up. We're the only country in the world that's cut carbon dioxide emissions over the last few years by 12%. We're back to where we were in 1994. It's because we're shifting away from coal towards natural gas. Now, other countries are increasing their use of coal. European countries, unfortunately, England, and Germany's carbon dioxide emissions are going up. So Germany is a big believer in wind, and they've invested in the infrastructure, and I wish we would as well here. I wish we had the money to do that as well here. But as a result, they don't like nuclear. They've cut back after Fukushima nuclear, and as a result, their carbon dioxide emissions are going up. So the only way we can actually do anything, make any dent in terms of global warming, is if we can convince foreign countries like China to start fracking and to start reducing their use of coal by and shifting to natural gas. That's what I would argue.
Gregory, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, great to be here.
That was Gregory Zuckerman with The Wall Street Journal. His new book is The Frackers.
We're covering the international talks on Iran's nuclear program, which resumed today in Geneva.
Now, these talks are part of the ongoing effort aimed at curbing Iran's nuclear ambitions.
Hillary Mann Leverett is with us now. She's with American University School of International Service. She's also the co-author of the book Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Hillary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So 2 weeks ago, the international community couldn't agree on terms with Iran. Now those talks are resuming. How close are they to a deal, do you think?
They're closer than they have been for over 10 years, which is when I started working on it at the White House during the Bush administration. We are closer now than we've ever been, and I think in terms of the negotiators, we actually have on both sides the most promising team of negotiators. On the Iranian side, we have both a president and foreign minister who have PhDs from Western universities in international law. The foreign minister has his PhD in international law from the University of Denver. And on the American side, we have Wendy Sherman in particular. She's our Undersecretary of State, and she's a very experienced negotiator. She dealt for years with the Koreans in the Clinton administration, very serious, focused, very, very smart person. I think if there is a deal to be had, and I think there certainly is one within the legal framework of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, this group of negotiators could get it.
Now, in between the time when the talks ended and now, there has been some rhetoric flying. There have been critics who have been using the opportunity to voice their concerns, including Israel and France in the past. They've been outspoken on this, along with some hawks in the United States. What are their concerns?
Well, their concerns very broadly are really the emerging power of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And for the Israelis and the Saudis, who have very similar concerns in this regard, the emerging power of the Islamic Republic of Iran in its nuclear power, its military power, its economic power, its political persuasion throughout the region is a direct challenge to their national security strategies in terms of how they deal with their neighbors in the region. So broadly, that's what's at stake for them. Even for a country like France, an emerging power like Iran or Turkey or China is threatening because France, in a lot of ways, is a power in decline and has very little other justification, really, to claim its Security Council seat at the United Nations other than it's a nuclear power. So for all of these countries that are opposed, there's a certain concern really grounded in competition for power and not so much a concern that someone's going to wipe someone off the map or destroy another country with nuclear weapons.
Well, some of the rhetoric, to talk a little bit more about that has been coming out in the meantime, it's been pretty intense, some of it very pointed, you could call it nasty, and I'm curious if you think whether that rhetoric is going to affect the negotiations going forward.
Well, I think actually, surprisingly in some ways, the most striking change in the rhetoric is from the Iranian side. I had the opportunity to meet with the Iranian leadership in New York when they were here to address the UN General Assembly in September and to go to Tehran. They've made a determination not to allow the type of rhetoric that their previous regime under, previous government under President Ahmadinejad spoke about, they're determined to not let that rhetoric be an excuse for Iran going forward in a variety of areas, including the nuclear area. So we've seen the foreign minister of Iran, the Islamic Republic, actually tweet in Jewish New Year's greetings to the Jewish community of the world, a very striking change in rhetoric. Just last night, the Iranian foreign minister put up his own YouTube video pleading for the international community to give peace a chance, that there really was a different way out other than war and never-ending cycles of war. It's a striking, striking video. So the real change has come. We'll always, of course, remember the strident rhetoric coming out of Iran. But the real change, I think, is coming in terms of the marked positive tone of it at this stage.
And Iran has been, you know, sort of helping itself along in terms of rhetoric in how it views itself. One of the terms that's come out recently in going forward is the term heroic flexibility, and that, you know, this could be the new stance that Iran takes as it moves forward with nuclear talks.
Yes, I mean, it's an interesting phrase. It's actually an older one that the founder of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, said many years ago, and then the new supreme leader, relatively new compared to him, Supreme Leader Khamenei, also said several years ago, but they haven't said it for a long time. And I think it does, it is another important indicator of their determination to do whatever is possible from their side to dial down the rhetoric, give a negotiated outcome in diplomacy whatever chance possible. And it's not just because they've become good overnight. It's a real strategy, and the strategy is that if they can show they've done everything they could, they've gone the extra mile in terms of being reasonable and working within an international legal framework, then even if the United States can't go along in the end because of our hardliners or the Israelis or whoever, that the rest of the international community can work more constructively with Iran. And that's what's really important to them as the, you know, kind of ground zero in oil diplomacy and petrodollars and all of the economics and power associated with oil is shifting from the United States east toward China and India. That's where their eye is. So even if they can't get a deal with the United States in Geneva today or tomorrow, their goal is to do whatever they can to be as reasonable as possible and open up the rest of the world.
Now, Iran has insisted that it has the right to enrich uranium and it is building a heavy water reactor. How does the proposed deal, as we know about it, affect those areas?
Those are two of the remaining very important sticking points. I mean, for many analysts, they couldn't even fathom that we would be where we were today 6 months ago. But literally, within the past 6 months, negotiators have been able to really whittle down the concerns that remain to be negotiated to three. One of them is this issue about the right to enrich uranium. The Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which the United States has signed and Iran has signed, Iran signed it as a non-nuclear weapon state, the U.S. as a weapon state. In that treaty, there is a recognition of every state's inalienable right to produce and use nuclear power. This is what Iran has really focused on. It doesn't want to give that up. It doesn't want that to be a decision made by the United States, that if Iran is doing a good thing today or a bad thing tomorrow, it can be taken away. This has been a core concern, and I think if there is no agreement, it will be because the negotiators could not find a way to address Iran's rights in this regard without ceding our position, the U.S. position, that no country really has this right. So that's the main sticking point. The other one that I think is a bit of a sideshow that's been put out there, particularly by the French, is this issue of the heavy water reactor at a place called Arak in Iran. The reason I say this is not really an issue is that this power plant and reactor cannot come online for at least a year. So this agreement that they're working on now is just a first step. It's just to cover 6 months. So easily, lawyers could come up with language that Iran is not going to work on the reactor during the 6 months, is not going to start work, is not going to continue work. They could come up with all sorts of words to massage it. It's not a real issue. I think it's being put out there by people who don't want an agreement.
So in return for concessions, Iran would see a loosening on sanctions. And now the deal on the table is still largely being kept under wraps, but do you have a sense of how important it is for Iran to come out from under these sanctions a bit?
They would very much like to come out from under sanctions. They are a tremendously wealthy country with enormous, enormous hydrocarbon resources. If you count their natural gas and their oil, they have more hydrocarbons than Saudi Arabia does. So we're talking about a huge amount of resources that can be monetized and really increase the standard of living for the population. That said, they have their eye on a long-term goal, which is to get the international community, not necessarily the United States, but get the international community not to be tied to these U.S. Appointed sanctions. Now, if they can do it because the United States is going to lift them, that's great. That's their first choice. They'd like to have a more normal relationship with the United States. But if they have to do it in a way where the U.S. doesn't enforce them as much or doesn't add any new ones, that's also a win for them, because what they're looking for is more investment and more trade from China, from Korea, from India. So that's what, you know, that's what they're looking for. They're not pushing for the Obama administration to make huge cuts in the sanctions that the administration can't do anyway.
Now, this is an interim deal that we're looking at right now. It's not the whole thing. But if the six world powers accept this interim deal, what are the bigger fish that they might be after down the road?
Well, for Iran, it is really to come out from under the sanctions, to be able to have its economy fully integrated with the international economy, have its hydrocarbons fully traded and monetized, for them to have a full-fledged commercial nuclear program where they can even sell power plants to Iraq, to Lebanon, to other countries in their neighborhood. So they're very much looking at it in terms of economic and scientific development. For the United States, it's about trying to control, I think, you know, if we take the U.S. position at its word and at its word, they're looking to really curtail the diffusion of nuclear know-how and fuel cycle capabilities in order to stem the risk of proliferation for nuclear weapons. And this is where they see Iran as an important case. Now, the reason why I say if we take their word for it, the reason why we should have some skepticism with our own government is that that's not how we treat India. You know, we let India, with a full-scale nuclear weapons program, have an agreement with us for the trade in nuclear technology. We're negotiating right now with Vietnam to have the full fuel cycle capability and reprocessing facilities. So it's something where, you know, I'll take my government's word for it for now, that we're really out to make sure that there's as little proliferation of nuclear weapons as possible. But there are some serious other cases of double standard that we should all take seriously.
All right. And we'll leave it there. Hillary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Hillary Mann Levert with American University School of International Service. She's also the co-author of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickards.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. With the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy approaching, many are reflecting on the life, legacy, and politics of the 35th president of the United States.
And our next guest says that despite his status as a liberal icon, JFK's political career and accomplishments show the opposite, and he was actually quite the conservative.
Joining us now is Ira Stoll, author of JFK Conservative. Ira, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here again.
So is this hard to pin down, the words conservative, liberal, the policies they're attached to? They change over time. Is it hard to have this argument today over who was a conservative and a liberal 50 years ago?
I agree these definitions are blurry and they do shift over time. But I know a book full of evidence that by the definitions of both his time and ours, Kennedy was a conservative. Eleanor Roosevelt was asked in 1958 by a television reporter, what if the Democrats nominate a conservative like Kennedy and the Republicans nominate a liberal like Rockefeller? She said she hoped it didn't come to that. So Kennedy was labeled as a conservative all through his career.
How did he become a liberal icon, do you reckon?
Well, the argument I make in this book is that some of the more liberal members of his administration wrote these best-selling books that really distort the history to the point of excising sentences out of speeches and changing the chronology of certain speeches to make it look like wishful thinking. Kennedy was more liberal than he actually was.
Let's talk about a few of the things you offer up as evidence. You talk a lot about his tax policy. Make the case that we would recognize that then, maybe, and now as more of a conservative approach.
That's right. So the liberal Keynesian economists at the time actually opposed the Kennedy tax cuts, John Kenneth Galbraith wrote to a Keynesian Harvard economics professor who was ambassador to India, wrote to Kennedy, as usual, I would oppose a tax cut. They wanted to increase public spending instead. And then Galbraith actually came to Washington from India to argue against a tax cut. He went back to the White House mess and told his colleagues, dejectedly, you know what, you guys, you've won. The president finally told me to shut up about my opposition to the tax cut. Al Gore Sr., the senator from Tennessee, Clinton's vice president's father, it described the Kennedy tax cuts at the time as a bonanza for the rich, a bonanza for fat cats is the term he used. And Kennedy went ahead with them anyway, rejecting demands by the AFL-CIO that he restructure them so that, that more of the benefits went to lower-income people. And Reagan cited those tax cuts as an example later when he was doing his tax cutting. That when liberals say, oh, well, the rates at the time were higher, the Eisenhower-Nixon rate was 91%.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the capital gains rate at the time was 25%. Kennedy wanted to lower it to 19.5%, which is lower than the top capital gains rate is now. Now it's 23.8%.
But wanting to cut something from a 91% marginal rate over a certain amount of money, I mean, a lot of people in the, who would be considered liberals now might not be comfortable with that high a number.
Well, you know, now if you include state and local taxes, the top marginal rates in California and New York City are above 50%, with the government taking more than half of every dollar at the top end that people earn. Kennedy's Treasury Secretary, Douglas Dillon, who was a Wall Street banker and a Republican donor, who Senator Gore actually tried to talk Kennedy out of appointing as Treasury Secretary because he knew he was such a tax cutter, was interviewed immediately soon after Kennedy's death and was asked if this Kennedy tax cut was the end of the tax cutting or if there was room to cut rates even more. And he said he hoped it would be the first of many, especially if the Cold War ended and the government had to spend less money on the military.
So on domestic policy, people look back at John F. Kennedy as the guy who pushed for Medicare at the time. It was called socialized medicine, much like the Clinton health care program, the Affordable Care Act now. That's a big government program. Is that something that conservatives at the time or now would get behind?
Well, Kennedy did give a couple speeches in favor of Medicare. You're right about that. But liberals at the time were disappointed in him for not pushing harder. His priorities were really free trade and the tax cut. And I think it's one of the reasons that Medicare did not get passed during his administration, even though he had Democratic control of both the House and the Senate, is that he did get a free trade bill passed. And that was really his legislative priority, along with the tax cut. And not civil rights legislation either, by the way, which was a lower priority for him than the tax cut.
But still a priority.
Towards the end of his administration, in 1963, Kennedy proposed this big civil rights legislation. And I think Kennedy deserves credit for sending federal marshals in and even troops in to integrate some of the segregated Southern universities. But Martin Luther King at one point described Kennedy's record on civil rights as essentially cautious and defensive. And I think the record is mixed. Kennedy even initially opposed the 1963 March on Washington, where King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech.
Charlie in Milwaukee has called in to, I don't think we'll have time to take his call, but he says, you know, Kennedy's more of a pragmatist. He's making decisions, not necessarily on a conservative ideology, but on a case-by-case basis with what works. Is that a more accurate depiction of Kennedy, you think? Pragmatist, not conservative?
Well, you know, I hope people buy and read my book. There's really a book's worth of speeches from the very beginning of Kennedy's career. My book begins with a speech he gave as a congressional candidate in 1946, talking about the rights of the individual against the state and Christian morality. He talked about the cynical philosophy of many of our intellectuals and the doctrine of collectivism abroad. And he kept talking like that all through the 1960 campaign. He talked about two conflicting ideologies: freedom under God versus ruthless, godless tyranny. I mean, that's not the language of a pragmatist. That's a language of someone who sees it more clear cut, as he said in another speech, in terms of good versus evil, right versus wrong.
You mentioned Ronald Reagan citing John F. Kennedy's tax cuts. Other than that, have conservatives been willing to embrace JFK as an icon or as an example?
Well, Scott Brown, a Senate candidate in Massachusetts, began his initial successful U.S. Senate campaign as a Republican in Massachusetts with a YouTube ad that morphed Kennedy's face and speech about tax cuts into Brown's own face and Brown's voice speaking the same words. And George W. Bush also, in talking both about tax cuts and enduring in the Iraq War, cited Kennedy in terms of his inaugural address where he said, "Americans must pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe to assure the survival and success of liberty," or as Kennedy said, liberty.
Ira, thanks so much for joining us again today.
My pleasure.
That's Ira Stoll. His new book is JFK Conservative.